on this episode of Skeptico.
Actually, I think if people study cults and sects, that can make them more immune against the biggest sect in the world called society. Our zeitgeist, living today here, is being a part of a huge cult. And if you come from 50 years from now or 50 years behind from now, you know, from the past or the future, you'll see that you're in a psychosis. But any time and any culture has their own psychosis, their own sect. And in esoterica, there has always been a goal to be timeless.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Today we welcome Al Borealis to Skeptico. Borealis isn't his real name, but that's part of the stealthy image that he's created. Al is the creator and host of the very excellent Forum Borealis podcast, a podcast that seeks to bust all sorts of paradigms, be they scientific, political, religious, historical, conspiratorial, all of them and any of them. And what's really unique and special about Al is the way he goes about that and what his show is all about. And that's what I really want to get to today in this special coming out party. I've actually managed to unmask Al, so you're listening to this audio. But if you want to go up on YouTube, if they allow it on YouTube, you'll actually see Al on camera. That's a first, right?
It's a first, but I didn't say I didn't wear a mask.
That's right. Yes, do not be fooled. So just a little bit more, you know, when I say it's a special show, I mean, where else are you going to get 5 hours of interview with Peter Lavenda on UFO disclosure? I mean, that's remarkable. Yeah. Where else are you going to get 6 hours or more with Joseph Farrell just on JFK? And all of it, I've listened to every minute of it. It's spellbinding. I mean, it's just fantastic stuff. And then throw in a couple hours with the famous 88-year-old past lives researcher, Erlander Harrelson. I mean, this is just a diverse, deep dive into topics that weave together in a way that listeners to this show will understand. But I think most people are still left on the outside looking in terms of wondering how all that can happen. So, Al, it's just fantastic. I so love and appreciate your show, and I'm really grateful for you joining me today on Skeptico.
It's such an honor to be invited. You know, I told your friend Gordon, I think I came clean about the fact that before we started our own podcast, I didn't listen to podcasts. Too old school. So, but I did listen to yours. So it's pretty cool that I'm on yours then.
Well, it's really cool to have you, obviously. And I just want to share, I thought I'd share with people a little bit the kind of, I told folks what you're about, but I want to share a little bit of the vibe that you create at Forum Borealis just by playing a little bit of the intro that you do so that people can get just a sense, a feel for what's going on. Sure. This is from the intro to Forum Borealis.
How does it feel? Is it spooky?
It's interesting. We'll let it play for a few seconds.
Paradigm. Expansion.
Greetings from the north, and welcome to Forum Borealis.
That, of course, is Al's introduction. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to just get in there and ask this question, because you do have this mysterious element to the show. It's very, very accessible. I don't want to make it sound like you're kind of talking in rhymes or anything like it. It's very accessible, very penetrating, very well done. But there's a little bit about this mysterious north, great white northern islands of Norway. What is that all about in terms of how do you think that influences you and influences the show? And maybe tell people a little bit about what I'm talking about in terms of where you're sitting right now.
Well, Norwegians are, whether they want it or not, they are ingrained in nature. So we have the nature mystique. We haven't lost that so much because it's a huge country in terms of geography, but a small country in terms of citizens. So, like where I grew up, Bergen, it's called the city of the seven mountains. So it took me like 15 minutes to be on the top of a mountain, and it took me 15 minutes to go downtown. So we're very close to nature, and that influences what I believe Jung called the folk spirit, the folk geist, if that makes sense. So, and there's a lot of weird stuff happening up here too. You know, the closer you get to the pole, the more risky it is. So. We have like, and I'm going to have a show about that. When I started out, I didn't want to have a traditional UFO show. I know you didn't either, but you ended up there. You didn't have any choice, right? Kind of the same thing has happened here. But I've always known I'm obliged to cover one aspect of the UFOs, and that's what's called the Hasidal phenomenon, because that's one of the most scientific researched phenomenons connected to UFOs, and there's university people, university studies, all that stuff. So I'm going to have an academic on from my university who's going to account for that, because they haven't found little green men in spaceships, but they have found physical and plasma and energy and astral and all sorts of weird light and energy phenomenons. It's been all over the mainstream press. It started out as a folk thing. We have many we have our own Loch Ness monster, by the way. That's another place. So in these different nature places, different stuff is going on. And if you are familiar with mythology and folk lore and stuff like that, we have a lot of stories about, for instance, pretty virgins being taken by the Mountain King, the elves and the creatures living in the mountain. We're not as extreme as the Icelanders. They have never upgraded from the Viking time. They still go out and sacrifice to the wood spirits and the mountain dwarfs and all that. They're really in touch with their land. But we have it more. We lost the deliberate contact, but we have the subconscious contact still. And, you know, today people are growing up without even, you know, living in big cities. They never even see nature, many people. So I think that influences us. I don't know if I answer your question, by the way.
I think you have, and I guess I'd even draw it
that
further.
That was what you were going for, okay.
Well, you kind of took it in a slightly different direction that opens up another line of question, because reading between the lines, what I hear you saying is where you are in particular forces you to be more connected to nature, and by the same way forces you to be connected with this subconscious understanding of this greater reality. And as I say that, I want people to know that that's kind of an interesting insight, because I don't think folks would get that just from listening to Forum Borealis. I mean, like we're going to talk about on this show, none of the stuff we're going to talk about on this show is really related to any of that. I mean, you come at things from a very mainstream conspiratorial standpoint, if you can, or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but have you noticed I rarely use the word conspiracy?
Well, it's a completely contrived word, right?
Yeah,
you're coming
sure.
at it from a reality standpoint, but if we say that, yeah, it throws people off. I mean, that's why they've kind of won the battle with conspiracy theory. Every time conspiracy theory, that phrase comes out of our mouth, they've won a little bit of that battle, but we still have to get there. But let me go back to your place right now where you sit, and I love what you said. I think it's interesting.
Maybe
expound
place.
On that even more. And then the team that you've put together and what your vision has been and is for the show, who you've attracted to the show. I always think that's interesting. You know, we all start these shows and we have one vision of who we're talking to. And then we find that our audience is sometimes slightly different from that, and sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a way we can't understand. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, that whole process of Forum Borealis?
The audience.
The audience, the impetus for starting it, the team that drives it, any of that stuff that pops to mind?
Well, the audience are pretty bright. I'm not saying, you know, I've seen hosts, you know, lick the asses of the audience telling them how bright they are. But these guys are bright. Case in point, Peter Lavenda, you mentioned him. He's done many shows with us and he's game for many more, but he never, you know, those people are so busy, they never listen to what's going on, right? They don't even listen to their own interviews. And so they will know what old stream media is hot. They won't necessarily know what new stream media is hot, but somehow he stumbled upon one of the videos we made and he started to read the comments and he was amazed. How, because you know YouTube is really troll city, right? And it's the basest comments that usually end up there. But when he read our comment section, he had to kudos the level of insight there. And I think the reason is twofold. One is that we actually attend our comment section so far. I don't know if we can continue doing that for a very long time because it's just exploding, but and if the people commenting know that the people who's, you know, if they feel a presence, they're gonna behave a little more real, I think, like if you're actually sitting in a forum and talking. The other thing is that when we have like kind of book review shows, I'd say it's kind of like many of the guests, we go through a book which is reflecting the show. That attracts book readers, you know, or it creates book readers. And book readers are, per definition, a little more reflected. So I think that's part of the reason we have a kind of a bright listenership. But it's, of course, also that we take on topics that I think are among the more sentient in that field that you unfortunately describe as conspiracy. So we try, I deliberately avoided the obvious bunk and stuff that I personally think is more likely bullshit. So that, you know, then you have one foot in reality and it's easier to, objective, agreed upon reality, and it's easier to open the veil to, you know, peek behind the immediate reality. I think that's some of how this came about with the people we have.
Absolutely.
Which I don't think is too different from your people, though.
I think it's true. I'm amazed at some of the people that are attracted to Skeptico. And that's what's really driven me forward, really, to be honest with you, is that because then I'm getting something out of it, right? I have to say, you know, I've started putting some videos on YouTube and I've yet to gain that kind of traction in terms of intelligent comments. It's really discouraging, some of those comments.
Yeah, but you have that. No, you have that, but you have that in your, I've seen it, it's in your forum.
Yes.
That's where your people are talking. You haven't been a YouTuber, so.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's out there. It's encouraging to hear from you that it's out there because, I mean, I get 1 out of 10 comments on YouTube that I can even get through without just, and not all of them are negative. I mean, some of them are like positively stupid, like cheer you to death stupid, you know what I mean? Like, did you're being complimentary, but you didn't really get what I was saying, so I'm not quite sure what to do. with your compliment. But you know what?
Yeah, but again, you're not a YouTuber. They're not going to YouTube to see Skeptical. So whoever you get there are just extras, are just, you know, coincidental randoms falling in from the street. Your people, they are pretty smart, and they ought to be, because you started out in a completely different direction than me.
I did, but it's interesting, and one of the things we want to talk about is how those directions have converged, because I always bring this up with people, and no one seems to get it, you know. Well, I mean, like, part of the feedback I'll get, even from people that have been with me for a while, is like, and I don't want to get too far off into this right now, but like, gee, why are you so into conspiracy stuff? I'm like, I didn't mean to. Sorry. No. Sorry, just spent 5 years...
It's where the breadcrumbs end up, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. 5 years with, you know, bashing into the skeptical bullshit that's completely co-opted science. And I mean, if at some point you don't scratch your head and say, hey, maybe there's something else going on here with this agenda. And similarly, you know, to your credit, we're going to talk a minute about Erlander Harrelson. And, you know, you're doing an interview with a guy who is a very skeptico kind of guy. And you do that stuff for the, and I think that's where we kind of cross paths in a beautiful way that makes me feel like I'm on the right path, because I'm crossing paths with other people I really like and respect who seem to be following the same strings on the sweater, and they're leading back to, oh, okay, I get it. And I guess that brings up this whole, the first topic I wanted to kind of dive into, and that is this truth-seeking process. So if you can kind of go behind the show, behind Forum Borealis, I mean, what drives you? What gets you excited about that process? I mean, I know what does for me, you know. What makes it like, man, I just get the juices flowing when I learn something new, or in my case, sometimes when I kind of nail somebody on something that they're not totally being upfront about or trying to hide, you know? Well, do you have any thoughts or stories about, you know, particular interviews you've done where you really dug into a new area that, you know, really kind of changed your perspective on things?
Yeah. Damn, you're asking very good questions. I have to think and reflect, and I haven't got enough coffee to do that, really. But yeah, I didn't expect that. When I began, I just wanted to cover, it's like what I've heard you say. you came clean once in one of your shows. You said something about, first off, you said you could get free books. That's a good reason to start a podcast if you're into books. But you wanted to talk with people, right? You just wanted to talk with people like Sheldrake. Same here. I've been talking with people all my life. Big shots, like in certain circles. And I've said this before, otherwhere. I said that I wish there was flies on the wall, because when I've had very interesting conversations, it kind of a waste that I'm the only one who, you know, listens to this and learns from that. So I've often thought, you know, if that person was here now listening to this, whatever, right? And you can't really retell. It's something magic about the spoken word, the living word. When a lecture is very different from a conversation. And conversations are the clue, by the way. Many newbies don't get that. We got a lot of people falling in from the very popular Antarctica show, and they're used to, you know, one-liners. Some prescriptive one-liner and then a lecture in reply. They won't get that here. And not at your place either. I like that. But so conversations is the name of the game, and it's very old school. I'm actually inspired specifically by two shows on Norwegian radio. As for the format, not the contents, but so I didn't realize that I would learn that much and that my perspective would change. I mean, I'm not a dogmatic person, but I thought I had many bases covered, And then I forced my paradigm. I was supposed to alter the audience's paradigm, but my own has been altered too. I'll give you one. I don't enjoy nailing people. That's not my style. I know you keep saying I do challenge them, but that's what happens when you have natural conversations. It's not that I'm trying to challenge them. And in fact, if and when I do, you'll notice I do it in a very, I don't want to say sneaky, but a very pleasant way. And it's easier to do it if they don't, because, you know, emotions cloud thinking. So you better keep bad emotions away as much as you can. Try to be a little detached. I guess we could call it professional. And be immersed in the subject you're discussing. And if that happens, then, then I can challenge. But usually I try, if I talk at all, it's three reasons. One, sometimes I try to be a good host and imagine the audience, and you have to, you know, sometimes engage to adjust stuff so that the audience follows. So I would, you know, the guest assumes everybody, and especially if I'm knowledgeable about the subject, it's very easy to become like an elite kind of, just you have to earth it once in a while to get everyone with you, as many as possible at least. We don't have too many newbies, but you know, just to touch base and make sure everybody's on board. That's one reason I interrupt. Another reason is that I get engaged and I want to offer my two cents, because nobody can offer all perspectives, and two heads can better, you know, enlighten a topic, more focus, more angles. So that I do. And sometimes that's something the guests haven't thought about, and that's what I love. I love nailing them on that. Like I launch just, it often comes to me when we talk. It just comes to me. For astrologers out there, I have Mercury in Aries, the horns connecting all the way up, intuition. So, and when that happens, it's pretty funny. Sometimes I have to edit it because their reactions are like, they stop and they're not saying anything. And it's a little too long, you know. So I put them off. That's that I love. What's the third reason? So it is to guide people in. It's, yeah, and then it's to, you know, clarify. I don't understand or I disagree or whatever. A real kind of interjection. So that's enough. A conversation will come out of that. Obviously, the guest has the word much more than the host. But and you'll notice one other thing, those who have listened to almost everything, sometimes we do traditional interviews. If you hear me shut up a lot, that's probably because I don't know that much about this. I feel I don't know that much about the subject, so I better just shut up. Don't talk unless you have something to say.
Well, that's nice. You know what I really resonate with as what you said is your interruption is driven by engagement, the way that I can tell it. Because I think the whole interruption thing, I don't get when people say don't interrupt. I mean, it's like you said, it's a conversation. It's two-way. But what I particularly like about what you do is you're willing to go there and risk that interruption, risk that kind of break of this, oh, we're all friends, I have to be totally complimentary and agree with everything you say, because that's not real either. That's not the way real conversations happen. But I love when you bring insights to the guest that the guest maybe hadn't seen before. And, you know, the example we might get to in the show, if we get around to it, if we can spend enough time talking, but your interview with Joseph Farrell, and I listened to it and I was just blown away by a couple of the insights that you had, that you could see Farrell, who is a genius, everyone has a lot of respect for Joseph Farrell, but it set him on his heels a little bit, like, wow, I hadn't really thought of that. And to me, that's a special moment in the show as a listener, because now I feel like there's been an engagement that I'm a part of. Just like you said, that conversation, I was there for that minute when you said that. So I always like that. And I think also, you know, like you alluded to, where you sit is a special place. The number of people you talk to, the preparation that you've done to talk to those people, the follow-up that you've done to talk to those people, you are a wealth of information at this point that I want to hear on your show. So, yeah, I do kind of like that. And I want to then, as I'm patting you on the back, I want to add to it and tell you a couple other things I really appreciate about what you do and I think is somewhat unique, not totally unique, but unique enough. One is this, what I call unsiloed. You know, you are not in a silo. So you can switch and fluidly move from talking about UFOs to talking about consciousness to talking about politics to talking about religion. Why wouldn't you, is always my thing. Why do I have guests, even people that are just purely, I respect, and everyone is interviewing and everyone likes them and they have all their books. And now I ask them about ET consciousness. They're all into consciousness, you know, and they're all into this. And now you talk about ET consciousness and they're like, well, I don't know. I don't have any opinion. I've never looked at how? How do you not have an opinion on that? How have you put yourself in that silo? And the two other things I'll just point out, and then I'll just get your feedback on what you think is important, is you take extraordinarily deep dives into this topic. Topics that you cover. You're willing to spend, like we said, 5-6 hours with people broken up over a series of interviews. And I think, I know because we've talked in the past, you've really kind of broken through to a new potential there that a lot of people didn't see, because conventional wisdom was, oh, you can't talk that long to someone. No one will listen, you know. And you've shown just the opposite. You've shown that people really do want that depth a lot of times, at least the people we're talking to. So what do you think about those things?
The last thing, I'm not sure I agree, actually. If I had, and I hope we will disagree a lot, because we really disagree too little. We know that. So we'll try to find some disagreements today. This, no, it's just the effect of the internet, man. I could have like a show about baking raw cookies and there would be a lot of people, but who would tune in, because you have the whole world as a potential. Whatever weird thing you have, you can, if you can reach them, you know, that basic marketing, you know that. There's always going to be an audience for something, a segment, a niche audience for something. If I had babies and cats or makeup, it would be 10 times the numbers. I'm not pleased with my numbers after I realized, you know, I was very early on. I was shocked that actually that this took off. And it was just at the end before they screwed up and manipulated the YouTube algorithm. Today, good luck breaking through at YouTube. It's completely manipulated. But I was at the end of the freedom where you could, you know, accumulate people, if you, listeners, if you, you know, if it had the life of right of life. So that happened, and enough for the world to be spread. But then I realized what's possible and who really gets the numbers, and then I came back to Earth because, you know, two little babies and cats. So I think there is an audience for these topics. It's a challenge to find them. I have not been mining in where you have, in the podcast world. And you haven't been mining that much in the YouTube world. And there's other platforms too. So the plan is to reach out in more platforms onwards, due to, maybe we'll talk about that, but the YouTube gate.
I think we handled that. I'll tell you what, let's go on to talking about consciousness and talking about...
Oh, but by the way.
Yes.
Can I say one more thing?
Of course.
About the time
because I hope you're going to do a Forum Borealis interview today, because you have very impressive preparations. I wish I could serve my guests. If you do this with everyone, I don't know if it's just me, but if you've done this with everyone, man, it's a really easy to be a guest on your show. So, but you want us to bite over a lot of stuff today. So I hope you're going to do a forum in depth. Otherwise, we can't cover those bases. And you were saying that, and I want to comment upon that. That too is just. Well, no, that was deliberate. I did want to talk a lot because I remember Joseph Farrell. He had many, many interviews on something called Byte Show, which was kind of a low-key, just very unpretentious thing where the host, she rest in peace, kind of just gave him an open mic. And they went for hours upon hours, and she never interrupted either, almost. And I realized in depth it's what's doing it for me. And so, you know, when I just started, I didn't have a podcast kind of. I wasn't going to build an empire or become a big voice out there. So what did I care, you know? Put on the mic and we talk as long as possible. Didn't have to think about anything, right? Except the conversation. And that's just become a trademark. I continue doing that. It would be very boring to make 1 hour shows, honestly. Our shortest shows are one and a half hour. Because that's how much you can squeeze those who are not used to long interviews. For them, that will be a long interview. Like, even the reason I haven't had Sheldrake on yet is because his handler said he only did 3/4. That's too short. That's very old school. You can't. What can you do? Even with 2 hours, you can't really go that deep. And when we're comparing with books, who go even deeper, you know. I think even my shows are superficial compared to the level that's desirable and ought to be there for people really to get it. And despite that, you still find people, you know, demanding the weirdest things, like, oh, you didn't cover this detail of the story. Well, read the book. You know, how much can we... Anyway, go on.
Well, I'm going to go on, but I love what you said. I mean, I think that ties back to what we were talking about before. So I want to approach these three interviews, and we are, now I'm going to have to own the fact that we're not going to cover them as completely as I'd like to, as they deserve. But maybe we can give folks a little bit of an overview, an entry point for how they would dive into Forum Borealis style stuff. And I came to this idea of really looking at the why question. So like the first interview we're going to talk about is the Erlander interview. And It's an interview about consciousness, obviously. It's an interview about a very famous, if you will, researcher who's now 88 years old, who has done
the reincarnation researcher today, when after Evan Stevenson passed away. He's the man.
He's kind of the guy. And then there's a lot to talk about in terms of, let me pull up that screen.
So what you want to meet?
So there's two points of that. I mean, one, I want to play a clip in a minute from this interview. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about is, you know, why? Why do we care about consciousness? How do you come to consciousness? Because like we said, I think it's kind of an interesting story how you came to it from one angle and I came to it from another angle. I came to it from just saying, okay, who are we? Why are we here? Let's go talk to some really smart people. And immediately you run into this thing called consciousness, and then you run into the outlying anomalous stuff, and boom, there you are. NDEs, past life regression, all the rest of this stuff. I feel like you came about it kind of from a different angle, but then why do you think it's so important? Why is Harrelson on your show? Why are you doing these deep dives, series of shows on this? I think it's an important question that reveals part of what's really going on in your thought process in terms of what you've figured out here.
Right, right. Well, I've been hunting consciousness since I was 16 years old. So for me, it wasn't coming to it. It was finding a way to putting it out there. I've started with anything but consciousness, but I always intended to have a bunch of esoteric shows. That's really the main passion. But I wanted to prepare the ground, and I wanted to explore phenomenons that are related, as you point out, and also, you know, I have to be honest, some topics are populism, deliberate populism. Like say the Antarctica show. I'm coming back to that because it's so popular. It's a basic, it could, you know, it can be a trivial mystery, but it has the aspects of connecting into almost anything. And I'm doing a show like that partly to, because if I'm going to flirt with phenomenons, that's a fun phenomenon. And then to attract more listeners and then see if there's, you know, how many of them can endure listening to. Let's say this chap, Cliff High, that I did Antarctica show with, he also has that kind of spiritual side. And we were discussing back and forth, you know, how many percentages of the people listening to the Antarctica show will bother to listen to our show about death. Like we have a reincarnation. I don't know, did you listen to that I did with him on reincarnation?
I think I listened to one or two of them. I can't remember. I'm almost sure we did, because he talked about how that's kind of required training for a lot of monks in the East, right? The first thing is death. Yeah, I remember that. As they go and look at the
funeral but he may have said that in the consciousness. We did a one on consciousness,
I think that's the one I heard then, the consciousness.
Yeah. But then we did a pure one on reincarnation, me and Cliff. And the numbers, only part one of the consciousness is out, and that's like 1/10 interest compared to, and that's AI and transhumanism ought to be a little popular, right? It's not that exotic. It's a reality. And then we did, it's not out yet, one on reincarnation and death, and that's, you know, it's probably going to be 1/10 of the consciousness show, because we're going deeper and deeper, and he says the deep people aren't interested in that. That many people, it's like a percentage all the way, and so we have to balance that for the topics we use. I don't write conspiracy as a topic we do, because conspiracy may be there on all of the topics or any of the topics. I write what they actually are, which is history, politics, philosophy, culture. And one more thing I forgot. So you can see the list. But we do different stuff like that. Wanted to say one more thing about that. Yeah, Al Under. So I wanted to start with him because he's, you know,
he's very an elder. Earth. He's an elder.
He's coming from science. This isn't woo at all. It's the scientific method, trying to explore something which is very hard for science to measure. And when he has established the overwhelming evidence, you know, where it points, then it's easier to do like a more purely speculative or philosophical spiritual show with someone like, for instance, Cliff High. I have very many great people lined up. Next year will be galore for spirituality and consciousness. But and some more politics. We started that too. We have to always keep one, you know, foot in. immediate, absolutely perceptible reality.
You know? No, absolutely. And this is kind of backtracking way back to the beginning of the show, or what I like about the show. It's like, you know, when people say don't talk about politics and don't talk about religion, the opposite. Always talk about politics. Always talk about religion, because they reveal two things. One is they're not real. We can talk about politics all we want because it's not real. It's a social construct. And even in that sense, it's a clearly at this point, it's a charade. If you don't get that, if you really think there in the United States, there is such a thing as a Democratic Party and a Republican Party, well, then you're not really bought your ticket to enter this conversation. You're on the outside looking in, and there's not much we can do for you. Same with religion. You know, unfortunately, I continue to return to those topics because I don't think we can really talk about extended consciousness and try and really get a full picture until we talk about religion and we talk about our susceptibility to cults, to being tricked, being fooled, to being controlled. So, of course, we want to talk about religion. And in your case, of course, we want to talk about politics. And it just, we have to, but we have to talk about it in the way that we're not talking about it because it's not real. But here's where, since you brought it up, I'd like to broaden this discussion about Erlander in a couple of ways, and really without even getting into the interview per se. I was going to play a clip from the interview, but I have to alert people, when you listen to the show, you did a fantastic job of guiding the guy through the interview, but he's an older guy.
It's a challenge.
He's not super fluid in his talk, and you do a nice job of bringing him along and stuff, but it's kind of a little bit harder to listen to than many of your other shows. But two things that are kind of like you and I can talk about and have an interesting time talking about that I thought would be fun. One is this idea of the elder and the person who holds the knowledge. And I see two sides of that. I see a great side of that that we should respect, and we should say that there's something that comes from writing books and writing articles, 100 peer-reviewed journal articles, that is more than that. And that is the experience that that guy had. I mean, we can sit here and talk about conspiracies and bullshit and myth of progress. This guy's lived it, man. He was there in the front lines of academia being jacked around and paradigm shifting. He lived that, and he's a living testament to that. But the other side of that that we can get your opinion on is, I think a lot of us have a sense of elders maybe not carrying the knowledge that they should forward, and that in this day of the internet, we have access to so much information that a lot of times when we hear people like Haraldson, we go, well, you know, that's nice. I can go search and find 10 different studies on past lives and children and 10 different interviews, and I can compare and contrast, and your value as an elder is maybe not what it used to be in cultures where that knowledge was more centralized in a few people. So I've kind of laid a lot on the table there, but what do you think about this idea of elders and how they hold knowledge and share knowledge in our modern culture?
No, I appreciate the role of the elder. I don't think that role is very prevalent in today's society. You know, the corporations are taking over, the propaganda outlets, the wisdom of the elder. That's an archetype. I do have elders I relate to in my life, in terms of mentors, maybe I could say, or guides. So I'm totally on board with...
You cut Haraldson a lot of slack in that interview.
Oh, I had to.
I'll be really blunt. You cut him a lot of slack, and part of that was because he is an elder, both in age, but I think it was also out of respect for what he's done and he's accomplished. And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. But I think it's worth discussing that. And I think, like, the other thing with Harrelson that you didn't call him on, that I think he should be called on, is here's this guy, he has all this knowledge, all this experience, and he goes and he gets, I think, my read of it, he gets tricked by Sai Baba, right? So yeah. Sai Baba is this Indian guru, now passed away, who is caught on YouTube just doing stage magic.
I thought
to
so too.
Manifest
I thought
stuff.
So too. I googled those videos. They were, first off, all of them were very bad quality, and I wasn't that enlightened afterwards. I thought before I interviewed him that Sai Baba was this big pedophiliac swindler who's been debunked once and for all. That was my going to position. Then he said that, and you know, he was very impressed. He had followed Sai Baba around, he and his team, for weeks. I haven't done that. I wasn't there. Sai Baba is dead. So a little humility is okay in terms of that. I don't know that Sai Baba is a quack. So I can't insist on that. But I did suspect it. Then I tried to research. I know you wanted me to discuss Sai Baba with him. I wasn't that interested, actually. But I did that. And I was kind of surprised because he had that position. And before the show, I think it was, or was it after? Either before or after, I checked out Sai Baba and I couldn't find, I wanted to find these obvious tricks that he had done, but I didn't find anything that really settled the matter either way. But I'm immediately skeptic if a so-called spiritual person is starting to make miracles. Like Ushu, I regard him as a big swindler. Ushu did what Crowley did. He took stuff that's already out there and he amalgamated it and put his own spin on it, which, you know, if you read something Ushu which is bright, it's either from Pythagoras or from Gurdjieff or from Buddha or from, you know, one of these greats, and if you find something that's fishy, it's usually from him. So I'll pick on Ushu all day long if you like, but when it comes to Sai Baba, he never interested me. I thought he looked disgusting, quite honestly. And when I looked into it, it seems that the movement he's created, and you know, there's some good stuff there. They do a lot of charity, and you know, people get something out of it. I know, but he's dead, right? But at least he created something that has some value at some level. I'll give him that. Now, Erlander didn't, you know, just blank defend him, but he said that it was I believe he used the word unsettled case, something like that. But that wasn't the interesting part. The interesting part was his research into death, which he's done in different ways, and the reincarnation thing. There was one huge important question that I regret I never asked him. But otherwise, I think I got to ask the most important question in terms of relating to, you know, for instance, you know, stuff that I wonder about. What about gender? Are we coming back as the same gender? Are we, you know, how long time does this take? Because I want to compare it also to the law that's already out there. Near-death experience isn't a new thing. You have huge traditions for this in spirituality and esoterica. There's even instruction manuals like the Tibetan Book of the Death, the Egyptian Book of the Death, the Eleusinian Book of the Death. And much of the knowledge of our ancestors harmonize with what the scientists have found out, and some maybe not. And that's interesting to find out. You know, if you've been studying death, if you've been working with death like I have, then it's interesting to talk with someone, a pioneer in the research field who has looked into. And I was surprised that he had an answer for all this stuff. He had thought about it. He had gone there and tried to find these patterns, which are so important. But it's a hearing thing, it's a language thing, it's the, I'm talking about interviewing a chap like the good doctor. If you're not 100% present, how can you get a flow of a conversation? So that was more traditional interview, actually, what I did with him.
See, my problem with the Sai Baba stuff, I mean, it speaks to process and method, right? So if you're careful about your process and you're deliberate about your method, then you don't get fooled. And so, again, we can leave it as an open question as to whether or not Sai Baba was legit. But he doesn't pass the smell test right from the beginning. You just look at the guy and you look at his claims, and they just line up with all the other frauds, you know, like Osho. You know, one of the biggest ones that I always point out, and I credit my friend Rick Archer at Boot at the Gas Pump for getting away from this cult, and that's the whole Maharishi Yogi, the guy who started the whole TM thing. I mean,
yeah, he's debunked anyway, isn't he?
What's that?
He is debunked.
He should be, but Marahesh University still goes on in Iowa. All his followers don't want to listen to the people who were there who says...
Yeah, that's the nature of sects. I mean, no matter how stupid a sect, it's never the rationality or the believability of a sect that determines whether it survives or not. And it's interesting you mentioned, because we're going to have something that people maybe thought we'd never do. We're going to have a series about cults and sects.
Absolutely.
You know, in the future.
Hey, let's go there a little bit. Give me the high points, talking points on that, because I think it's a absolutely critical topic to talk about. And again, to me, it seems like the more I think about it and look at it and talk to people, it looks much more like a continuum than a clean break. I mean, how are the religious traditions that are played out in society just completely different from cults? They're not. They're different in certain ways, but they're both tapping into the same human need, the same human frailties that we have, our desire for community, our desire for meaning. They've just learned how to push the buttons, and they're willing to push them a little bit more when you get to a cult. At least that's my take. Where do you see that whole investigation going from your standpoint?
Well, actually, I think if people study cults and sects and they understand what's going on there, that can make them more immune against the biggest sect in the world called society. Because we are just our zeitgeist, you know, living today here is being a part of a huge cult. And if you come from 50 years from now or 50 years behind from now, you know, from the past or the future, you'll see that you're in a psychosis. But any time and any culture has their own psychosis, their own sect, their own... And in esoterica, there has always been a goal to be timeless, you know, try to step out of time and space. And the best spiritual material in the world is that which is as little tainted by the zeitgeist and by the culture and by the time that it's produced in. That's usually what's what survives. Of course, stuff is being destroyed, but the more timeless it is, the more it appeals across time and space. It can appeal to different cultures easily, and it can appeal to... take a thing like Buddhism. I'm not a Buddhist, but that's pretty timeless and can work in many different cultures. But if you take a thing like American Christianity, which is just a 100-year-old religion, but it's what most Americans think of when they hear Christianity. It's a completely new invention. It has nothing to do with history. But that doesn't work everywhere. So the only way they can spread that is to destroy a culture and turn it more like, you know, the culture that America Christian fundamentalism grew up in. Then they can, for instance, our materialist culture that we are living in. So never underestimate culture. That's the filter that the group is having. And then you have the individuality aspect, the consciousness level, which is your own shades. So we all use sunglasses to, you know, to perceive. So I try to take on topics which do not, at least I try to reach the whole of the Western world, if not the entire globe, should be able to relate to what we are dealing with in our shows.
You know where I thought we'd go next, because we do have to kind of just glance over these topics at the high level, but
yep.
I want to talk about your interview with Peter Lavenda. And so if we're going to talk Peter Lavenda, and we're going to talk about this deep dive that you did with him on UFO disclosure, on the event that happened at the end of 2017, where they rolled out in the New York Times, we'll talk about who they are, a full disclosure, first time in history that the government, the United States government, admits, yes, there are UFOs. Yes, they have this advanced technology. Yes, we've been studying it. And then Peter Lavenda, along with Tom DeLonge, Blink 182, rocker turned UFO whistleblower, they come out with this big thing. Hey, everybody, get on board and know this. And you did this interview, and like I say, 5 hours at least with him. Tell us why, first of all, backing up, why the UFO topic is of interest to you. Why the tie-in, I think, is obvious to me, but I want to make sure that listeners understand, because if they listen to that interview, one of the first things they'll hear is both you and Peter saying, hey, we're not really UFO guys. And I get that totally on one level, but explain to people your interest in that topic.
My interest is reluctant. It's against my will. I really don't want to do UFOs. I was kind of interested in that when I was like 18. I was sniffing at parapsychology and many different weird stuff. And I got bored by UFOs. I figured, what does it really do for me? You know, for my personal development, my growth. It's not that spiritual. It was more materialist angle, of course, back then. So I didn't relate to UFOs for many, many years. And then there was a combination of different things. One of them was that I saw David Sirida's evidence, the case for NASA UFOs, narrated, I think, by this comedian, Hollywood guy, what's he called? Blues Brother guy. Anyway, so I saw that and my mind was blown, because if this stuff is up there, out there, what the fuck? This needs to be integrated into our reality, into our paradigm. Then I had, different intelligent sources about that, some experiences. Why are we covering UFOs? Because it's part of reality. That's why. I wish we didn't have to, but if we're going to cover reality, we have to. It has its place in it.
I get most of that. I wish we didn't have to. I don't know about that. I think that's where it takes us. Let's introduce people. Who is Peter Lavenda? Why did you do this deep dive? What were you getting at? What does the whole disclosure thing, this latest round of disclosure, mean to you? I've labeled it a political psyop. Lavenda is very, very much against that. You have an interesting back and forth with that in the spirit of what we were talking about in terms of you challenging people. You have a whole interview where you say, okay, Peter, I'm going to hit you with all the really tough questions. And you do. You really hit him with some really hard questions there as well. So
yeah, but those were questions that I knew were already out there. And if I actually had him on, I wanted people to get the chance to hear, you know, his take on those things, because it's not something that you'll hear otherwise, right? Unless he addresses it, and he did. And I was okay with that. So you feel free to try to deconstruct his answers, and if I feel it's worthy, I'm going to defend it.
Okay.
Otherwise, I won't. He says he's not married to any of this. I'm definitely not. I just want to get to the truth. And by the way, when I say I don't want to, it's because of the nature of UFOs. UFOs is something that is so easy to be used against. You know, it's something that here now, gone there. It's much better with, like Richard Hoagland says, he says, the reason I'm doing moon structures and stuff like that is because it's not moving, it's there. So we can much easier unveil it, relate to it, if it's something tangible, if it's something, you know, beyond us. Most of them are probably technological, and so it's a superb technology. It's like the ants trying to relate to, you know, a human passing through their anthill. So UFOs are very good to use to distract more than anything. And the spiritual aspect of them is, of course, interesting. You know, the shamanic and astral aspect of them. That's where it ties into spirituality. That's the archetypal thing. It's very interesting.
Usually, see, but what if it's more than archetype? That's where I think everyone's kind of missing the boat at this point. And that's that if we look at the technology angle, which is stunning, mesmerizing, travels at 7,000 miles an hour, stops, makes a right turn. Gee, we don't have anything that works like that. And then Tom DeLong comes in and says, yeah, guys, but don't worry. We're going to figure it out. Just give me some money for my new startup. And by the way, we'll get free energy out of it, too. And everyone's like, yay, free energy.
Are they? Everyone is like, CAA.
Yeah, well, but here's the other part of the narrative that gets me. It's like, wait a minute. If they're that far along on that continuum, the propulsion continuum, how far along are they on the consciousness technology continuum? Right? Because, you know, just the way you talked about it, well, there's this spiritual part and there's the Jacques Vallée part and the Whitley Strieber part and all these people.
Which are most more interesting in a way.
Why are we creating a dichotomy? Why are we saying one is one and one is the other? What is the immediate challenge for me?
The aspect is more interesting. It's the same phenomenon, obviously.
Well, but I'm suggesting that we don't know that, because if there is an enormous upside to consciousness technology, and maybe upside isn't the right word, but maybe if there's an enormous potential to consciousness technology, that a lot of the people in the AI kind of thing that I have kind of been less favorable of, but if there's a whole lot of stuff we can do in that realm. And when I say stuff, so it appears that ET is able to, one, manipulate our consciousness almost at will, speak telepathically, erase our memories, plant memories, cause us to do things, cause us to see things. If all that's on the table, then and they've created a technology to do that, now we're kind of getting into the realm of starting to wonder where these lines become blurred. Similarly, if ET is in that space of the death, right? So if the ET starts creeping into the NDE, starts creeping into the DMT experience, which we all know when Rick Strassman at New Mexico, University of New Mexico, the first guy who was authorized by the FDA to do psychedelic testing, and he gives people DMT, and they go there, and there's ET.
Can
and
I ask
ET
you a personal
says,
question?
Welcome. We've
do
been waiting for you.
With, do you have a psychedelic experience?
Do I have one?
Yep.
Well, not one that I'm willing to share or talk about, and not one like that. So...
But have you taken, you don't have to share, but have you taken, like, say, LSD or magic mushroom or DMT or anything like that? If you're comfortable with
commenting about that. Well, I have four kids, Some of them still in high school, so I'm not comfortable really talking about all that.
It's not drugs, you know. It's not drugs.
Who said it best? I think is Strassman. He said, you know, when people ask me that question, I realize that either way I answer it, I'm going to be pigeonholed and misunderstood. If I say no,
I choose not to answer. That's an answer too.
Right.
That's okay.
Well, but his point I think was beautiful. He says, look, if I say I've never had that experience, then people point at me and say, oh, well, you've never had the experience. If I say I had the experience, then they say, well, you're just going off of your experience.
Yeah.
You're not an objective scientist who's looked at the data. You're clouded by your experience.
No, but, this goes to the heart of science. A scientist, to be objective, you need to look at the data, but a scientist should also explore. That's an aspect of it. And the empirical side of science is important. So I believe any scientist researching consciousness should not just put their subjects through consciousness-altering experience. They should experience themselves. And there's this incredibly stupid meme among some people that, if you do that, you're kind of not being objective. But that's as objective as you can get, because then you have the same experience as all the others. Well, not the same experience, but you have the same conditions as all the others. And of course, if your experience blows you away, if you're a good scientist, you're still gonna be able to relate to that too, because that's what's happened with people. You can't have like the whole world waking up and then the scientist is like the one guy who's remained behind in an old paradigm. We have to get them on board because they're supposed to find answers. That's what they're supposed to do. All these other things are just in order to secure the quality of the information. So if that becomes so important that they can't even engage with the information, then what are we talking about? Not truth, not fact-finding. You see what I mean?
I do, but I think that view, if taken to extreme, always presupposes a lot of things about what waking up means, what enlightenment means.
Yeah, but let's say something happened. Everybody drank. There's an old Sufi story. Everybody drinks over water and everybody forgets. But let's say everybody drinks the water and everybody wakes up. Something happens. I don't know. We see a new color or something. Okay? Now, do you expect the scientists not to drink of the water so they can't see the color? Will they do a better job finding out what's going on if they don't do that? I don't think so. A real scientist, if you look at how science emerged, it was spiritual people, it was esoteric people. It was people who did go there. And that's why they knew that these things have to be explored, because they had their own experience with it. It doesn't matter if we go back to the time of Pythagoras or if we go back to the time of Francis Bacon or Kepler and Galileo or even newer times. Scientists should engage with whatever field they're studying, and they should try every mean to uncover. And they're not going to do it on the expanse of basic scientific principles. They're going to do it in addition. So if there was a way for a scientist to explore consciousness from within, he should do it. But of course, as soon as you do that, you're really into spiritual science, as Steiner termed it, like a mystic. A mystic is someone who scientifically explores from within the consciousness. Unlike the religion, where you're not supposed to experience or explore, you're just going to be told by these middlemen what's going on. But when we have a phenomenon like consciousness, which isn't, screws and nuts and bolts, it's you have. So what tool do we have? We have consciousness. That's a tool. We can use that tool. So I think it's basic. Any scientist who are supposed to explore, let's say, psychedelics should experience. He shouldn't be influenced while, you know, doing some research with someone else, but he should have that experience. Will make it easier for him to also or her to relate to the subjects. Anyway, I'm talking myself away from where you wanted to go. It was Lavanda and Tom DeLonge.
We'll get back there because it's a really interesting point that you're bringing up, and I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it, and I think we're in a great position to chat about it. You know, I just interviewed a guy for the second time, and I love this guy. His name is Dr. Donald DeGracia, and he teaches at Wayne State University School of Medicine. He's just a top-notch scientist. He's got all these National Institute of Health grants. He's studying stroke victims and nonlinear cell dynamics in a way that's just completely revolutionizing the field. But that's not why I talked to him. I talked to him because he had an out-of-body experience as a teenager that led him to have a psychedelic breakthrough that led him
kind
into...
Kind of like that other chap you've interviewed who had a near-death experience and who was so attacked from that. Brain surgeon or something?
Right. That's Eben Alexander.
Yeah.
And
kind of like him then.
So all these... So, but that maybe gets to my point, you know. So Don DeGracia, eventually he winds up doing a deep dive into yoga and yoga philosophy, and he's written these books that are phenomenal on yoga philosophy, yoga understanding of consciousness. And I love because he does these presentations to all these really, really smart people like at the Society for Scientific Exploration. And yep. He's really a cool, nice guy. And then at the end, they ask him questions and he just slashes them down because he just knows he's just really brilliant. But my point is, what are you going to do with Don? Are you going to... Don has an out-of-body experience. He also has an experience with psychedelics. He also has yogic experiences with meditation, all of which are pointing in... And lucid dreaming experiences.
Yeah,
so he has all these different experiences. So I think as soon as we start putting down these ideas that... Well, you know, that person has to have this certain merit badge of doing 7 grams in a dark room, you know, before we can trust him. Bullshit. That's where we have to lean back on the scientific method because we've so gotten away from it in terms of really evaluating what is good science, and as limited as it is, understanding that it's limited in a fundamental way and that we can't really measure the outside world, but as long as we're going to play the game that we can, let's do it in the best way possible. And in that way, I think we have to be really careful about laying down some meta rules about the players of that game and what merit badges they have to say that they have to have before they enter the field. I don't give a shit how many grams you've done in a dark room. Show me the research. Show me some good research and, you know, I'll read it and make up my own mind. And then when I want to go in the dark room, I'll go in the dark room. And if your research benefits me before, during, or after, great. But my experience is my experience.
Okay. Well, you know, science. Let's take a thing like out-of-body experience. I'm going to do something I usually don't do in my shows. I'm going to be personal. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, but it goes to illustrate the point. I had one once where I had the wits to explore scientifically. Because it happened, and I was laying, it was the studio in Oslo, horrible place anyway, and I was laying in a bed, and I realized, damn, I'm out of my body. Ooh. So I was going out and in, and I was like, Rick, I have to look up. So I was supposed to rest a little before a course I was supposed to have. And I was pulled, yanked, jerked, out and in, out and in. And so it was like my legs wasn't there. It was the upper and out of the belly and down next to the bed. So like the Aladdin lamp spirit, you know. Yeah, it doesn't have legs. He just kind of, that's how it felt. And then I realized, wow, I had to, and it was in a dark room. I have to explore this now while I have the opportunity. And there was a mirror on the wall next to me. And I was thinking, this is an excellent opportunity. What happens if I look into that mirror, right? Because what was, is this a real thing? So I did. I did look into the mirror. And you know what I saw? I saw a negative of myself.
No way.
Way. And I was so shocked, trauma. I didn't prepare for that at all. And especially when it's a negative, you know, you look pretty spooky, right? So my eyes even scared myself. So I was so scared that I, from that I ended up in the body again, thrown back. Now, I couldn't discover, I'm not saying this is an objective experience, maybe other people will experience something else, but this is an example of what you can do if you're scientific minded, if you go into the experience. You couldn't have done this from reading a lot of meta studies, if you see what I mean. So science is not just collecting studies and comparing patterns overall, because there can be many things that can influence, real things that can influence that we don't know, we don't understand the context. There can be like a unique experience that can be an objective and scientific valid one, but it won't be reported in the meta studies, for instance. So science is about both that laboratory, distant, detached thing, but it's also the explorer thing, the detective thing, investigation thing. Both of them will uncover facts that will help us understand a phenomenon better. So I'm still saying that a scientist should dare go there, especially if he's going to be a pioneer and do new discoveries. And especially if he's dealing with stuff that's not just, you know, dense particles.
Awesome. Hey, I'm so glad you got that in there. It's an awesome story.
Okay.
So let's return to this really, really excellent three-part interview you did with Peter Lavenda on Disclosure. And we've kind of nibbled around at the edges of this UFO ET consciousness question. And I think some important ways, but maybe you want to tell people a little bit, just background information on who Peter Lavenda is, the Sinister Forces guy, very extremely intelligent, brilliant guy. But tell us who he is and why you felt like you wanted to do this show. I you've already told us you were kind of dragged into the show a little bit, but
yeah, it was pretty urgent when it happened. And I knew I had access to one of the people with their hands into the pie. So I wanted to milk that. First, I felt it was my obligation to cover this because it was so close to stuff that we do cover, like the classified space program. And we already had like Lavenda lined up for many shows. And when this thing, he broke it. Well, he told us in an old interview with him, when it happened, even. He said, I've been contacted, I can't say by who. We have that on air. And big project, blah, 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 blah. So I've been there before it happened. I talked with Lavenda before he was in touch with these people. I talked with him when it happened, and I've talked with him as soon as the stuff got out. And I wanted to be among the first, because there was so much speculation, there was so little. And here, I'm usually, you know, I think I told you this too, we're usually the last with anything, never breaking news. we swipe up whatever all the people have forgot. We go in depth and we see if we can squeeze out some more, right? That's what usually what happens. But here, I had an opportunity to do more like, for instance, dark journalist who's always in the front of what's happening. So I thought, okay, let's do it. It's interesting, it's related, and it's breaking news. And I thought it would be like the Antarctica show. It didn't actually. Probably because I didn't debunk it. I just tried to find out what's true. But who is Levanda? Levanda is a very, very rare thing today. Like John Pilger in political or war journalism, social reality journalism, or Robert Fisk. You know, he's an old school boots on the ground journalist. And they, or investigative writer is better, author is better to say than journalist. And they are not very common these days. And it's gone so far as to people having forgotten their value and why we have them. And he is well known for having sticked his head into all sorts of Pandora's boxes. He's been frequenting Satanists. He's been frequenting Nazis, war criminals, terrorists, intelligence people, all sorts of dark and sinister and obscure. That's what he wants to do. He's writing books about, you know, when he writes a book about Mormonism, it's not the, you know, the trivial stuff. You're going to hear all about the shadows. Yeah, Typhonian magic, he's written about that. So he is his brand mark to go into the weird and obscure and the sinister. And this is used against him. Because it started with, because he has views like every other human being. And when he goes into the Nazi thing, obviously a lot of Nazis are going to be audience. And they're not going to like that he takes a stand against it, and he does. That's just what he does. And then, of course, he's a shill because he doesn't expose the Jews. Because that's the one thing you can take him on, that he has not written about Zionist crimes. But it's a complete short circuit because, first off, he's grown up in the Bronx. He has close friends who are Jews. He's not, you know, this isn't an issue for him. He, you know, people have beliefs, and if you're not an anti-Zionist your own paradigm, you're not a shill just because you're not. These people are expecting that in order for someone to write something true, you have to agree with the reader on every single point. And if there's one position you take that the listener or the reader doesn't agree, that's it, you're a shill. And then you're fucked. Excuse my French, because you can never please everybody. Never. And there's always going to be a lot of crazies anyway. So all you can do is investigate something and put it out there as truthfully as possible. And if you're honest, you're also going to offer your own 2 cents. And he does that. He takes a stand. He's not like... Because real journalism is not neutral. It's objective. But it's not neutral. That's the problem with America today. You have like any TV channel say, well, he says this thing, he says that thing. What's the truth? I don't know. Imagine doing this on soccer, you know. Brazil and Norway just played. But I'm neutral. Who won? I don't know.
Right.
So you have to, but you have to be objective and report the facts. It's actually, Norway is actually 3-0 over Brazil in soccer. So if that's the fact you report, you don't have to like it and you don't have to cheer for anyone, even if you secretly are following one, but you have to be objective. And Peter and Joseph and many of those people I have on, I think they are objective. They're trying to be objective, but not necessarily neutral. So just because someone has an opinion that's different from you, you're insane. Okay, so if you're going to use that measuring stick, who can you really listen to? What books can you really read? Nothing. and why use it on, and usually something completely irrelevant from the topic. In this case, in the Tom DeLonge thing, it's not, because it's not the Zionism thing he's being criticized there by Nazis. There he's criticized him for being maybe either being used as some stupid, naive child who doesn't understand that that can happen, or he's even in on it.
But hold on. Let me interject here, because I love the first point that you made. I think that this gets back to the first topic I want to talk about in terms of truth seeking. And you just laid an absolute essential component on the table that we need to talk about, is that if you've constructed your truth seeking methodology such that you have all these trigger issues that if anyone touches them, then the bomb goes off and they're on the out and now you're on the in. If that's the way you're operating, you're right. You have no way of sorting through these issues, because they're all going to be layered with complexity and conspiracy and misinformation, disinformation, and lack of information is the biggest one. So I'm totally with you on that. But I would say that, like, you and I need to raise ourselves to a higher standard, to a higher level. I know you do, because you're engaging in this dialogue. And I'm saying, hey, to me, Lavenda seems like a political operator all the way. And I'm going to point out the reasons that I think he is. That doesn't mean that he doesn't, that he's not a good guy. That doesn't mean that he isn't super well-versed in a lot of other things. It just means that, and this is the other thing that
frustrates. No, but it means the most important thing, is he honest about his work?
And is he honest all the time? That's the other thing I think people aren't willing to accept. You know, if you're out there in the real world, if you're out there in the world of business, if you're out there in the world of power, trying to make things happen, you realize there's some corners that need to be cut, and you can't tell everyone all the truth all the time. The world just doesn't work that way. So,
no, but that's about if you have deals or discretion. Like, you must protect your sources, for example. It's true, he doesn't say everything. I know that for a fact.
I'll play you this clip, and it'll jumpstart us right into the conversation that I want to have.
Sure.
I finally realized Tom was Tom. And Tom said, listen, we have to get to the bottom of this. We have to do what we can to once and for all make some progress on this UFO thing, because everybody's going around in circles. You know, everybody is just repeating everybody else. Yeah. There are no good sources except Project Blue Book or a handful of government documents. Past that, there's nothing. And all we're doing is running around in circles. Each side is blaming the other side for being disinformation agents and all the rest of it. And it's a mess. How do we solve this? And the only way to solve it is to scrap everything we think we know, start from a fresh page, and say, okay, there's a UFO phenomenon. What can people tell us about it? People in positions that people who would know. So our approach was to go to people in the government, people in the military, people in the intelligence agencies, start from there just to see what shakes loose.
I'm going to stop it right there.
I love your notes. I had to laugh. I'm seeing your notes there.
Oh,
I look forward to you hitting me.
God, I mean, yeah. for people who are deep into this, I just ask you to take a step back and do a reality check. Forget everything you know about Peter Lavenda, how much we love him, how much we respect him, how much he seems to have some deep state connections all along, given what he knows. Does that make sense? Let's go to the people who have lied, distorted, killed people, threatened to kill people. Let's go to them. Yeah. Our first thought was, let's go to the intelligence agencies so they'll tell us the truth this time.
No, it's unfair, and I'm going to explain why. Because this happened, this isn't unprecedented. It's happened many times in terms of UFOs. It's happened with Stephen Greer. Everybody was hallelujahing that. And I was impressed by that too when Greer had these people up there. And it's happened with the Citizens Disclosure. It's happened with, there's one more project. slips me now, but you've had like three big, before this, three big disclosure attempts, insiders coming out. He, DeLong and company did exactly what people have done before, what they've been screaming and demanding. I've never been screaming about this, precisely because you are in the predicament that can you trust, you know, why do you demand the people you claim lying to come clean about it? Because if they do come clean about it, and it's true, you're not going to believe them. And if they do come clean about it and it's not true, you're not going to believe them either way. So you're kind of, it doesn't work. Whistleblowers, insiders, Joseph Ferrell makes a point of this many times. It's not really a good source for knowledge. Documents, evidence, phenomenons, stuff like that is a good source. So I don't think that we can expect too much from this, but they're saying themselves, our target is not, you know, the professional ufologist crowd. It's the main
stream. That is extremely suspect. That, to me, is a classic talking point. You know what?
I disagree, and I'll tell you why.
Well, let me just lay this out there, you know.
Sure.
I'm into the near-death experience science. If someone came out with a new near-death experience study, and they said, you know, I'm not really interested in talking to the near-death experience community, which in a lot of ways kind of parallels the UFO community. There's some kind of, you know, strange people, if you will, who go to a lot of conferences and maybe are into it in a way that a lot of people can't relate to. But those are the people that have really invested and are somewhat of the gatekeepers for the public at large. If someone came out and said, oh, I need to do an end run on all those people because I want to get to someone else, man, that's talking points. That's operations of disinformation and misinformation. It's classic.
Could be.
And to say that, that's why, I mean, let's move forward on this thing because we're going to disagree on that and I'm comfortable with
this. But I want to put why I disagree out there. I want to substantiate. I don't just want to spew opinions and people have to, you know, interpret it or accept them. I want to explain why. Because what you say is true. It could be all that, but then you're forgetting to read it at the basic level where it's presented. It could also be true from that basic level, which is, okay, if these people are insiders, let's get what they have, what they know, what they can share. But the most important thing, when I say they're trying to reach the public, that's not suspicious. It can be suspicious, but on the face of it, it's completely logic. It's what you would want to do if you want to move the culture forward. And that's what they have done. Because they didn't went to YouTube with these things. They went to the lamestream corrupt media, the Washington Post, the New York Times. Yeah, but I'll tell you something, Alex. The old stream media is still working in the bubble. And the bubble is international. So our lamestream media never reported stuff like this when it was on YouTube, when it was on Forum Borealis or Skeptical. But you know what they did? They actually reported it because it was in New York Times. The most trivial, the most brain-dead media talked about it. And how did they talk about it? Not like they usually do, which is the smirking and the laughing and the dismissing and the detachment thing. Let's not go there, you know, this is a joke. No, they spoke seriously. Suddenly the skeptics, you know, the international cult of the skeptics had to defend. They were starting to, yeah, okay, so that happened, but it could be this, that. They were really on the back feet. And all sorts of, you know, ordinary people were blurping out what they've been thinking all the time in the comment fields. Yeah, yeah, we're probably not alone. There's probably something. They actually succeeded to put it on the agenda of the mainstream. And they say that's one of their goals. And so I say, do it, have fun with it. Nobody's stopping us geeks from going deeper, like we always done anyway, right? But we need someone to bridge the gap between the public mainstream and their outlets and, you know, what we're into. So I'm not saying that I know for sure that everything is completely clean and up about this, but I'm saying this isn't a mystery. It's working. They're saying this is what they want to do. I accept that, and I applaud that.
I hear you. There's a reality to what you're saying, and it is great that it's out there. I'll just leave this topic with three data points that, to me, make it pretty clear that it's a political psyop.
Okay.
The first is the whistleblower idea. You know, at least here in the United States, we don't have whistleblowers. Whistleblowers go to jail. The kid who took the selfies inside his submarine innocently and sent them to his girlfriend, he goes to jail. So there's no such thing as a whistleblower unless they want the information out. I had the opportunity to interview Leslie Kane, who I really like, and she's fantastic. And she's the one who wrote the New York Times article and published it, one of the three authors of it. And I pushed her really hard. It was on the Grimerica show. And I poked her really hard. But the one place that she responded that I thought was very telling in a way that, to me, reveals the whole thing, she goes, "But this wasn't classified."
Right.
I'm like, does that make any sense to you, Leslie? We all agree this is probably the biggest story, certainly in our lifetime, maybe forever. And we have a government that's very interested in keeping and protecting secrets. But you're going to tell me this is not classified? By what phony baloney system?
What wasn't classified?
What Elizondo revealed. That is, look into that. That wasn't classified. Well,
that makes sense then.
It makes sense that it was a controlled political psyop. Because otherwise, why isn't this? There is no such thing as whistleblowers. It only comes out if they want it to come out. Classification and declassified documents.
There are whistleblowers, but maybe not in the UFO fields. And yes, they are arrested.
They are. That's what I mean.
There's a union for whistleblowers, actually.
Yes, and there's all sorts of laws, and there's all that. So I'm saying this in maybe way. I hope people sometimes take it totally literally, and they go, "Oh yes, there are whistleblowers." I realize that.
No, I just did.
I'm just saying. So here's the third point, and the one that we'll leave it with that I'd really like you to respond to, because we've already touched on it. And to me,
I wish we could go a little deeper into this.
We'll go as deep as you want. As deep as you want.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole project didn't work. So Lavenda, to me, is clearly a globalist. Not in a bad way. People think that's a bad term. Hey, there's just a certain group of people politically motivated who see the world as being full of problems that can only be solved at a global level. So those people are opposed to people in our country, people like Donald Trump, who say, no, we have to fight that pull for that globalist kind of thing. We just want to be left alone. So I don't want to take a side on that. I just want to point that out, that that's just the reality of the world that we face. And the globalists, not to put them down, I mean, they have a point, right? There are certain problems that we face that do have to be looked at a global level.
Like what?
But I'm suggesting that the only way to understand Tom DeLonge and Peter Lavenda and this whole rollout is as a politically driven rollout of another issue that is playing into the globalist kind of political sphere and puts things in a way that can only be understood globally. And I would point out, as the evidence of that is, listen to Peter. Mm-hmm. Go listen to Leslie Kane. Go listen to Linda Moulton Howe. Go listen to Richard Dolan. I've listened to 12, 14, 20 hours of them. You know who they never mention? They never mention the guy who's the most powerful political figure in the world right now, who's anti-globalist. So whether anyone likes Trump or not, why would that position, that political position,
be
left out of the conversation? They pretend that that isn't even a reality. So,
Okay. First off, he should be mentioned for two reasons. One, because Elizondo, closest friend, is Mad Dog Kelly, Trump's general. So if the government has a hand in this, it's actually the Trumpian faction. I don't think that, and I'll tell you why, but I just have to say also the other thing that's very interesting is...
Let me just interject something while you're pausing, for a minute, because here was really going to be my point in all that. To me, the evidence that it is, as I said, is the fact that it didn't work. It didn't
work.
What
didn't work?
The intended purpose... The intended purpose of that whole, that was the biggest rollout of information, of disclosure in the history of the world. They did everything they could to try and make that change the hearts and minds of the entire planet, and it completely failed. So, my story, and I've told this before, is the soccer dad story. I'm on the soccer field watching my daughter, and a friend comes up because he knows I'm interested in this stuff. And here's his story. He goes, "Hey, did you hear about that UFO thing in the New York Times?" And I just nod my head. And he goes, "It's really strange because it was like a big story, and then it just went away. That is, I think, the public perception is what happened. This was the biggest story in the world. Why did it go away? And no one's asking that question. Why weren't they able to make this thing happen? They were trying to make it happen. They got to all the news outlets. They thought they would make it happen. They thought this would be top of issue for everybody, and it just didn't fly.
Something very interesting happened right after, and it's gone under the radar. I haven't seen it discussed, and I'm going to discuss it with Catherine Austin Fitz and at the end of this month, and I'm going to discuss it with Joseph Farrell, because those two are very well positioned to speculate about that. And what is that big, big bomb? It is that Trump, and I sent you this, Trump suddenly goes out on a press conference that hasn't been covered enough, and he basically whitewashes the secret space program. And I finally have Michael Schratt on as a guest. I'm going to discuss it with him too, because I don't know if you've seen his material, but it's amazing. So this happens right afterwards. You're right in that they managed to create a blimp and then it went dark, which tells me that they weren't clear to do this, and that the outlets were kind of, you know, stopped or hijacked or whatever. I'm pretty sure, like you, that they know more than they're going out with. And I'm also pretty sure that if they went too much, too fast, whatever, they would be taken care of. Like you're saying, people are arrested. But there are, if you look at the, what do they call it, the intelligence people for sanity or something, there's a bunch of very great people, like Ray McGovern, like this Greek guy Kakwaki something, like this NSA guy Bill Binney. There are genuine, and of course we have Snowden and Assange, he's not American though, but there are genuine people coming out with stuff that they're not supposed to. And they are not necessarily killed. Boiling Frog, this
yeah, she's good.
Yeah, she's great. So I think Alessandro and those guys are balancing, like I said in my own show, either they come out with this, they're not allowed to, and now let's see how we can save it, or they already had, were allowed to come out with something, or, you know, I laid out the scenarios. I don't want to recap it here. It will take too much time, but I've gone through all the scenarios, and I can see what globalists or the powers that be could gain from this. All they have managed to attain is that a few more people is now open to the phenomenon. That's, you know, follow the money, they say, and who benefits, they say. So I ask you, who benefits? How is this a sinister plot? If it's a sinister plot from the top, letting us know about it, I suppose...
it's climate change.
No, let me
it's
say
climate
one thing.
Change. It's a problem that can only be solved at a global level. Therefore, give your rights up, give your freedoms up.
No, you're talking about Act 2. Act 2 is very important. I mentioned that too in my pontification at the end of that show with Levanda. I said that if they try to spin this in a particular direction, that's when we know what this is about. Because if they are going to, and this is what Tom DeLonge got a lot of criticism for, because he flaunted his opinion. And his opinion, and before they reveal anything, he said it in his opinion, these are bad guys, you know, pretty much the opposite of what Stephen Greer says. Now, if the powers that be comes out and says, yeah, we have to recruit a lot of soldiers to fight the bad aliens, or we have to do this or that, or more control and blah, 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 then you can close your case. You can have a hypothesis now that something sinister is in the oven, but you have to argue for where it's going, and you have to use objective facts to back that up. And so far, we haven't seen anything except the Trump thing. And the Trump thing can have been provoked by this. It doesn't have to have anything to do with it, but it's very close in time, very related. And what Trump is doing there is either a whitewash. You know, it could be like Trump gets wind of this, looks into it, and because I don't think they want to tell him too much. If nothing else, then because they know they can't trust him not to blurp out something. But let's say he got wind of something, and he gets wind, oh, we have this technology, wow, yeah, let's use it. I want to use it to my advantage. It reminds me a little of what Obama did with Bush. Bush had in the pipeline to use the death of Osama as a trump card, as an ace to win the second. But that was foiled partly, I think, by Alex Jones, and because it became like a huge meme that they're going to say they killed him. And they kind of ruined that. It reminded me of, what's her face? Benazir Bhutto, the Pakistani prime minister who was killed right after she came out with the fact that Osama was in this dialysis machine and all that. And he had already died from that. And so to tie this back, so it reminds me of that because Obama used that. As soon as he took over, he took that point, and Bush and those people in the neocons couldn't, you know, go out and say, no, he's lying because Osama's been dead all the time, right? So he used that political point, milked it. It was just bullshit, everything. But he could use it for his own gain. Smart guy. Now, Trump may do something similar regarding the space program. He may get wind of something's going on. I want to use this. I want to, you know, we're going to space, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. First off, he's not interested in that. But he has a guy in his team that is, and who bragged, and he knows what's going on, and that's why he tried to use it as a winning point when he was running for president, and that's Newt Gingrich, the Antarctica farer traveler. And so Newt Gingrich wanted to colonize the moon when he was a president candidate, so, and he's on Trump's team, so you know, Trump has access. So either it's Trump hijacking this, trying to use some of it for his own benefit, or it could be the ordinary whitewash. We have chemtrails gone already. Now we're going to customize people to it. So let's start discussing it as a real thing. You know, aerosoling, the weather modification. They're now discussing doing chemtrails in the not just contrails, but in the classical chemtrails definition. Same with Mars. Let's say we've been on Mars. Now we're talking about going to Mars to acclimatize people. So they never have to come clean and say, hey, we've been there, if we're already starting to establish ourselves there. That's how they do with all these things. Internet was around long before the public got access to it. They've already had it for military use. So we have stuff, and the way to whitewash it is to make it trivial and accessible to everyone. So that could be going on with the secret space program. That may be what Trump is doing. Either he's doing their bidding, or he's hijacking it, or it was triggered by this thing that just happened. Because in either case, if there are advanced spacecraft out there, definitely we have something. It doesn't have to be that we are everything, but we know we have something. And Michael Schacht is going to put that to rest. It's not going to be a debate after we've talked with Michael Schacht. So what did they accomplish? I think they accomplished as much as was possible. I don't think they saw coming the huge backlash. Almost everybody who's interested in this dismissed it without evidence. And I entertain the spooky scenarios. I fully get that. But I don't want to... I want to be scientific about, because it's too important for us to kill it because of our own... We're like battered children, children of alcoholics. They don't want to hear the... They attack the messenger. And so I've never been one of those who have screamed and demanded disclosure. But when something like that finally happens, the same people who demand it doesn't believe it. And that didn't happen in the attempts before. It didn't happen. Stephen Greer is still walking around like some kind of prophet, profiting from this. I'm not saying he's not sincere. I'm just saying he became a big deal. And he
It's pretty suspect when he stands on the stage with Richard Doty. And the same thing with Lavenda, the way that he recasts and reimagines someone who...
I think Ravana's honest.
Completely in the most just terrible, illegal, terrorist way, abused Paul Benowitz, drove him crazy, all for the reason that some... honest American came forward and tried to help his country by disclosing information, and these guys just did this psyop on him and run him into the ground. For Lavenda to not stand up and say, "Yeah, everyone associated with that needs to go to jail,"
But
you know what? I want to leave a little bit of a cliffhanger here. We've been at it for a while. We need to wrap it up. But what a fantastic...
No, but I did some research for your benefit.
Okay. I got to stop rolling out the ending, because please tell me.
Well, you haven't hit me with the factory yet. Weren't you going to confront me with the fact that Lavenda is a member of a certain organization?
I don't know where to go with that completely, but I'm working on some more solid data.
Because I have the answer for it.
No, let's leave that. Let's leave that as a cliffhanger, because we have to do this again. I hope what we accomplished today was really what I set out to do, and that is to give people a sense for what Forum Borealis really is, and it's fantastic. I mean, the depth of knowledge that you have, the ability to have this kind of unsiloed approach for us to be able to have spirited discussions where we disagree, and for you to bring all this new information to the table, it is just refreshing. It's energizing. It's the kind of stuff that I love to do. And I listen to your stuff all the time. I'm a member. I get all the inside track stuff. Other people, if they just start listening, will find the same. And I'm just so thankful that you came out from behind that mask. Although, as you said, we don't know. You might still be wearing a mask there, but this is a rare video appearance as well as audio appearance from Al.
I'm going to retreat right back into the shadows when we're done here.
Hey, man, it's been absolutely great having you on Skeptico. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Al Borealis for joining me today on Skeptico. If you didn't get enough of this conversation, and I didn't, then you're in luck. Because after we finished this show, I got to thinking about this whole process that Al goes through on his show and the kind of interaction we've had both during this interview and off interview. And I wanted more. I wanted to try and find some closure and some potential new areas to explore, because I feel like we didn't really nail some things down. We didn't dive deep like I feel Al does so wonderfully on his show. So I called him up and I arranged another interview. Now, that might be a little bit much for some folks who've had enough of this topic, but I think some really great stuff came out of that second talk, and I'm going to sample some of it for you right here so you get an idea of what's coming up on part two, which is going to be released next week here through the Skeptico feed. The shaman thing may be wrong. They may be looking at a very underdeveloped sense of manipulating certain aspects of consciousness in the same way that when we look at ancient agriculture, we say, wow, they did pretty good. They had that little stick and they drove it in the ground and then they stuck a fish in the with every corn seed and it grew. Hey, good for them. You know, right now we get 100 times that by doing all this kind of manipulation, some of it good, some of it bad, but we figured out how to do that at a whole different level. So the fact that these ancient people figured out a way to perform these tricks, manipulate this other dimension, we'll just keep calling it consciousness for lack of a better word, maybe we're over-impressed by that.
Oh, I think we're under-impressed because you fail to see, there's something you fail to see in that reasoning. Look, they were having archaic consciousness or magical, mythical, depends when we're talking about. So that means that they were dealing with the same things, but they were expressing and experiencing differently. Look, I said people had a different kind of consciousness before. That means that what they perceived was also different. If you kill all technology on Earth, just try to imagine like a meditation exercise or something. It's almost impossible. People in nature, like us Norwegians, we know. Norwegians are very atheistic, or I should say agnostic. We're probably the most secular, one of the most secular in the world right now. But all Norwegian, when they go to the mountains, when they go to the forests, they become extremely humble. And they connect with something. Now, we prefer the technical way to explain it rather than the mythical because we're lost from that part of consciousness, but it's still there and we still know about it. It's a reality. So if you go back to such a world where it's just completely quiet, I've lived in complete isolation. I've lived in places where you had to drive a car for half an hour to get to the closest groceries. I was surrounded by wild beasts and creatures. That's it. It was completely dark. It was completely quiet and it was completely lonesome. The three big fears people have, right? Silence, darkness, and loneliness. I conquered them. And I have to say, if that was the world, I think you're forced into other frequencies with your consciousness under such circumstances. Or the other way around, the modern technology, the modern society has forced us into the so-called technical consciousness. And so we stop relating to those other possibilities in reality, except via matter, via machines, via technology, which is really a bypass. The shaman, he had a direct connection.
So that's what's coming up, and I hope you do stick around for that. I do have a number of other interesting shows coming up. I will release Al's second interview next week, and then the following week I'll have a new episode of Skeptico. I have some interesting ones in the queue, and I'm going to be doing a little bit of different things with them. I'm kind of going back to my roots. I've been playing around with video and YouTube, and I'm really not satisfied with the compromises I have to make on the audio in order to do the YouTube videos. So I'm probably going to be moving away from that and moving back to my roots. And moving back to my roots in terms of pursuing the questions that are presently on my mind and leaving behind the stuff that I feel like I've covered or satisfied my own curiosity about, and looking for the new things that I want to tackle. And I certainly hope and would love for you to come along on that journey with me. So if you like this show and you want more of it, check out skeptico.com, S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O. You'll find all the shows for free, and you'll find a bunch of other stuff there, ways to connect and all that good stuff. That's it for this episode. Until next time, take care. And bye for now.